Another reason, I don't remember. Pax fanned through the pages of neat handwriting, much like Bibi's cursive script 12 years later, but with girlish flourishes that she no longer employed. Sometimes she dotted an I with a tiny circle, sometimes not, apparently preferring the circle when the word was particularly colorful. And she always dotted J's with asterisks.
She wrote the first draft of each story in a tablet, Pogo said. Edited it a couple times, then copied it into the notebook.
Short stories filled two-thirds of the volume. On the first blank page following them, Pax discovered two lines of verse that he recognized as coming from one of Bibi's favorite poems, The Evening of Mind by Donald Justice. Now comes the evening of the mind. Here are the fireflies twitching in the blood. The stories had been written in blue ink. These lines of verse were in black. The blue had faded with time. The black remained dark and appeared freshly inscribed. Not a single eye had been capped with a circle instead of a dot, and there were none of the other flourishes to be found in the handwriting of the 10-year-old Bibi. Still puzzling over the leather collar, Pogo said,
She told me Olaf was wearing a worn-out, muddy collar when he showed up in that rainstorm. But she never told me there was a name on it.
Jasper. The name of the dog in these stories. Maybe she knew someone who had a dog named Jasper, and this was his collar.
Pogo shook his head.
The dog in the stories is her invention, entirely. And it was smaller than Olaf. A black and gray mongrel, not a golden retriever. This collar would have been too big for Jasper.
Pogo turning the leather strap. The buckle softly clinking. Bits of dirt flaking through his fingers and onto the table. He said,
What are the odds that she'd write all those stories about an abandoned dog named Jasper? And one day, an abandoned dog named Jasper would show up at her front door.
The best in Vegas couldn't figure those odds, Pax said. Maybe what you're wondering is, could it have been a coincidence?
Looking up from the collar, Pogo said,
You think it could be?
Bibi doesn't believe in coincidences.
Yeah, I know. But could it be?
I don't believe in them either.
Putting down the collar, with the name revealed, Jasper, Pogo said,
Then what the hell? Why did she never tell us?
Pax didn't know what to make of this development. He was pretty sure, however, that although the shared name seemed like a small, if freaky, detail, Jasper, the fictional mongrel, and Jasper, the golden retriever, who became Olaf, were of considerable importance. Intuition, the knowledge that comes before all reasoning and teaching, raised the hairs on the nape of his neck and lowered the temperature of his spine. Instead of answering Pogo's question, he said,
Let's see what else is in this box.
And he picked up a small Ziploc plastic bag of the kind that people often use to hold the day's vitamin pills or prescription medications. It contained a withered scrap of scalp with an attached lock of hair, the lower third of which was matted and crusted with what must have been dried blood. Chapter 97. Where shadows live, their shadow lives. Armed and anxious, Bibi argued silently with herself about the necessity and the wisdom of venturing uninvited to a house as strange as the one that stood like a massive gravestone in a desolate plot of the Mojave Desert. She approached the residence overland rather than along the county highway, through sand and loose shale and parched vegetation, all vaguely phosphorescent under the moon, which deceived as much as it illuminated. She was noisier than she would have liked, especially as she had imagined herself whitting through the arid landscape with the grace of a coyote. At least the night was chilly enough that she didn't have to worry about rattlesnakes, though she thought that scorpions might be scuttling through the darkness. The house faced north, and she arrived at the east wall,
along which she made her way, cautiously looking in the lighted windows, which were curtained only with shears. The rooms were furnished, but quiet and without occupants. As at the front, the house at its south side lacked a porch. Only a 6-foot square pad of bricks presented the back door, which had been broken down as if with a battering ram that had torn it off its hinges. The breached door lay cracked and splintered on the limestone floor of a hallway lit by frosted glass sconces. The evidence of violence should have turned her away. She went inside. She had never seen the house before, and yet it felt familiar. She had a fragment memory of Ashley Bell standing in a front window, in this place. The voice, issuing from the electronic map, telling her that she would want to stop here, had been that of a young girl, perhaps that of Ashley. Bibi couldn't retreat. Impossible. She had been spared from cancer to save a life. And only she stood between death and a girl of 12 or 13. The fallen door rocked underfoot, an unavoidable clatter, though she got quickly off it. No one called out or came to see who might be responsible for the noise. The residents stood in silence. Upon entering the house, Bibi had also entered a peculiar state of simultaneous knowing and not knowing. It wasn't quite déjà vu, the illusion of having experienced something before that, in fact, one was encountering for the first time. She not only recognized things as she encountered them, but also had continuous presentiments of what lay ahead. A laundry room to the right of the hall. Yes. A walk-in pantry to the left. Yes. And ahead. Yes, the kitchen. But though she could predict what room came next, she couldn't recall having been there before. The kitchen was rather primitive by 21st century standards. No microwave, no dishwasher. The gas range and undersized refrigerator, bearing the name Electrolux on its door, were many decades old, and yet looked new, or at least well-maintained. In the other rooms, the furniture was oversized, but sleek and modern. Art Deco pieces of Amboyna wood, others of polished black lacquer. All of it expensive in its day, and far more expensive now, having become uber collectible. Here and there, a chair or a desk had been overturned, but most things were as they should be. The glass in a break front had been smashed, but not the contents that the cabinet displayed. The destruction wasn't systematic, instead almost casual, as though whoever did it had come here on a more important task than vandalism and had committed this damage only in passing. As Bibi returned from the drawing room to the front hall, she glimpsed swift movement to her left, a dark and darting form, tall, thin, stoop-shouldered. She pivoted toward it, pistol in a two-hand grip, but no one was there. If the presence had been real, surely it would have made some sound. Swift footsteps, a creaking of mahogany floorboards, a ragged inhalation. But the uncanny silence wasn't disturbed. Besides, the figure seemed to have moved with inhuman speed, crossing the hallway from room to room in a fraction of a second. The window from the fragment of memory in which she had seen Ashley standing in a white dress with pale blue lace collar was on the third floor. She climbed stairs to a landing, and then another flight. As she neared the second floor, an inky form, so swift and fluid that Bibi had only the impression, not the conviction, that it was human, appeared above her and plunged past her. Although the figure didn't brush against her, a coldness prickled across her in its passing, and she almost lost her balance. She fell against the railing, remained upright, and turned to look down, in time to see a shadow disappear off the landing, onto the first flight of stairs. She couldn't know if it might be the same spirit, if spirit was the word for it, that she had seen in the ground floor hall, but she sensed that it wasn't flinging itself through the house in a rage, that it was instead a spirit in extreme torment, sustained here by anguish, vigorous with the energized despair called desperation. When she got to the second floor, she found a dead man lying face up on the carpet runner. He appeared to have been beaten to death with truncheons wielded by a man or men for whom physical violence was an intoxicant. His clothes were a blood-soaked shroud, his face and skull a cratered terrain from which she had to look at once away. His crime had been resistance. He had dared to protect his own. She didn't know how she knew this, but she knew. If Ashley Bell was still here, perhaps she would be on the third floor, in the room with the window seen in the fragment of memory. Heart racing, feeling as might a deep-sea diver in a pressurized suit struggling toward the surface countless fathoms overhead, Bibi went up more stairs. The pistol was strangely heavy, and her wrists ached with the weight of it. Chapter 98. A Little Trove of Traumas. Sitting in Bibi's kitchen, Paxton repeatedly thought that they needed candlelight, that he should put half a dozen or more votives on the table, though it was only 2:15 in the afternoon, with sunlight strong at the windows, and though the occasion certainly didn't call for a romantic atmosphere. And several times, he detected the rich fragrance of roses, although there were no roses in the apartment, nor any air freshener, as far as he could see, that might explain the phantom scent. These odd sensations felt akin to those moments in the hospital room when Bibi's voice had come to him. The perfume of roses wafted over him again when he stared in puzzlement at the tiny plastic bag that contained a desiccated scrap of human scalp, from which sprouted a lock of thick white hair, matted around the roots, with dry, rust-red blood. "Well, if we're looking for un-Bibi," he said, "this seems about as un as it gets."
"In a way, yeah. And in a way, no," Pogo said. "The day of her grandfather's funeral."
"Captain, you mean?"
"Yeah. Everyone came from the cemetery to the bungalow for the usual get-together. You know, food, booze, memories. Like 70 or 80 people. It was a crowd. It got noisy. I realized Biebs wasn't there anymore. She was torn up. She loved the guy. I figured if she'd go anywhere, she'd go to the ocean. So I walked down to Inspiration Point, and there she was, sitting on a bench. She didn't see me until I sat beside her, and she was holding that little plastic bag in both hands."
Pax said,
"This is the captain's hair?"
"Yeah. Seems when the aneurysm broke, he must have shot to his feet before he fell. He was a tall guy. On the way down, he hit the edge of the table hard, right at the sharp corner. Left behind that piece of skin, and the hair stuck to it. Bibi took it after she found him. Kept it."
"Why would she do that? Seems too macabre for her."
"She didn't say why, and I didn't ask. We've always been totally open with each other about most things, you know. But there's always been this need-to-know clause, too, and neither of us ever violates it. She made me promise not to tell anyone, and I didn't. Until you. Anyway, I was just 8, she was 10. She was teaching me to move from a belly board to a short board, and she was a goddess to me. She still is. Always will be. You expect a goddess to have secrets. It's part of their mystery. And you don't want to learn their secrets, because if you learn them, you die."
Pax considered the contents of the plastic bag for a moment, but then put it aside to examine the remaining 4 items in the metal box. Chapter 99. The Girl Who Loved Horses. In the third floor hallway, beyond the topmost of the stairs, a dead woman lay as further testament to the savagery of those who had invaded the house. Perhaps the corpse on the second floor had been her husband, and she had stood here as a last defense against the invaders, because not far from her lay, of all things, a pitchfork that would have no purpose in this elegant and stylishly furnished residence. The tines of that rustic weapon weren't wet with blood, so Bibi could only assume that this poor woman, who lacked the effective defense of a gun, had no chance to wound the murderers of her husband. She didn't want to examine the corpse, but she felt obliged to have a quick look at it, as if she owned a portion of the responsibility for what had happened here and must answer for it, though of course she wasn't accountable for what Terezin and his followers might do to anyone. They would do the same, or worse, to her if they got the chance. The woman had been shot more than once, in stomach, chest, and face. Bibi looked away, less in horror than in pity, as if to conduct even one more second in autopsy would somehow make her complicit in the murder. She didn't think that she would find a third dead body, but she proceeded along the hallway in dread of precisely such a discovery. If Ashley had hidden in her room, they would have found her and taken her away. According to Terezin himself, he wanted the girl for his upcoming birthday. Most likely, on that day, she would be raped in imaginative ways, later tortured, and then murdered in a ceremonial manner, as in his madness, he set out to launch once more the final solution of what Hitler called the Jewish problem. But if the cultists, Terezin's followers, had not taken the girl from the house, if she had resisted, as her father on the second floor and her mother on the third had resisted, their intention of taking her alive might have been foiled. When she came to the room on the left, at the end of the hall, where the door stood half open, Bibi knew what else she would find, in addition to either a dead girl or no girl at all. Horses. Pistol in her right hand, aimed at the floor, no longer concerned that any of the fascist murderers remained in the house, Bibi crossed the threshold. Her premonition was fulfilled. Paintings of horses, bronzes of horses, porcelains of horses, books about horses. This house was one more thing that Bibi had forgotten, apparently by using Captain's memory trick. She had been here before, but she didn't know when or for what purpose. Hour by hour, she found more memories that had been burned, fragments of which survived in ashen form. This house, this room, the fact that Ashley Bell loved horses, might ride them as well as admire them. She thought, I must know Ashley. I must at least have met her once. Why else would this residence be familiar to her? How else could she have known about the horse motif in this bedroom? The doors of a tall built-in armoire stood open. The clothes that had hung within it had been taken out and thrown on the floor. She approached it with trepidation, although she didn't raise the pistol. The secret panel in the back of the armoire, which Bibi had somehow known would be there, had been slid aside. The closet-sized space thus revealed was unoccupied. If the girl had hidden there, Terezin and his men had found her. Chapter 100. The Clock, the Watch, and the Ovens. Suddenly Paxton felt that they were running out of time. The sensation came out of nowhere, for no apparent cause, an impression of a brink looming, a void beyond. He became certain that Bibi was receding from him, captured by someone sinister and being carried away at high speed, in what direction and to what destination he couldn't know. Which made no sense. She was comatose in the hospital. Nobody could abduct her from a secure medical facility. And if her condition had changed, Nancy or Murphy would have been on the phone to him. The fourth item in the black metal box was a small recorder. It contained a microcassette, but they couldn't listen to it because the batteries were dead. While Pogo searched pantry shelves and kitchen drawers for spare batteries, Pax examined the fifth item, a twice-folded sheet of lined yellow paper on which were written a number of quotations and the attributions of their sources. The handwriting wasn't Bibi's, neither her precise adult script nor the decorative girlhood variant. The strong, slanted cursive seemed to suggest that a man had composed the list. The cheap paper was deteriorating at the corners, foxed by time and skin oil, and it had been opened and closed so many times that at some point, the folds had been reinforced with scotch tape. Pax began reading the quotations aloud for Pogo's benefit.
"This world is but canvas to our imaginations." "That's from something by Henry David Thoreau,"
Pogo said.
"The Walden Pond guy."
"So you paid attention in school after all."
"No matter how much you try to keep that stuff out of your head, some of it gets in."
"The next one's also from Thoreau. If one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours."
Having found a package of Duracell AAA batteries, Pogo brought two of them to the table.
"Was Thoreau the Walden Pond guy and the Power of Positive Thinking guy?"
"No, that was Norman Vincent Peale. This next one's by someone named Anatole France. To know is nothing at all. To imagine is everything."
"Maybe I'm seeing a theme,"
Pogo said as he removed the dead batteries from the recorder.
"Me too. Imaginations, imagined, imagine. Here's one from Joseph Conrad."
Pogo said,
"The Heart of Darkness guy."
"Kid, you are such a fraud."
Pax cleared his throat and then read,
"Only in men's imagination does every truth find an effective and undeniable existence. Imagination, not invention, is the supreme master of art as of life."
"That's heavy, dude."
The sense of time running out, of some catastrophe looming over Bibi, grew stronger. Pax glanced from his watch to the wall clock, where the second hand swept smoothly around the face, but where the minute hand twitched from 2:19 to 2:20, clicked like a trigger.
"Here's another one. Kenneth Graham wrote..."
Pogo interrupted.
"He's the Wind in the Willows guy. Mr. Toad, Mole, Badger, Ratty, the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and all that."
"So, he wrote, as a rule, indeed, grown-up people are fairly correct on matters of fact. It is in the higher gift of imagination that they are so sadly to seek. You know who Wallace Stevens was?"
"The poet guy."
"New batteries don't help. The recorder is biffed."
"Biffed?" "Biffed. Totally thrashed, broke, whatever. But I know someone who can fix it."
"So this Wallace Stevens poet guy wrote, in the world of words, the imagination is one of the forces of nature." "There's one more. You might have heard of him, Shakespeare. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name."
Pogo considered Shakespeare and then shook his head.
"It'll give me a migraine. What do you figure the list means?"
"Whatever it means, I think her grandfather wrote it."
"Captain, yeah. And I think she's the one who opened it and read it so often. She wore out the creases."
Pax glanced from his wristwatch to the digital time readout on the microwave, to the digital readout on the conventional oven, to the window, where the afternoon light hadn't begun to wane to any appreciable degree. Nevertheless, within him, a clock spring of worry wound tighter, tighter.
"You got a dance to go to?" Pogo asked.
"Bibi's talking to me again,"
Pax decided.
"What's she saying?"
"It's not words this time. It's a feeling. The time's running out. That someone bad is coming after her, and fast."
Pogo looked grim.
"The brain cancer.
Not something bad. Someone.
Nancy and Murph are with her, one or the other, usually both, and not just them.
It's not something that'll happen in the hospital. It's going to happen wherever else she is.
Pogo said,
I know we're in the Twilight Zone. I accept that. But it still sounds nuts when you say things like that.
Pax took the sixth item from the document box, a children's picture book with a story told in short sentences and simple words. Cookie's Big Adventure.
That's been in print forever, Pogo said. It was Nancy's favorite when she was little. She gave me a copy when I was 5.
Didn't Bibi like it?
Yeah, I guess, when she was little. Personally, I didn't think it was such deathless literature.
If she liked it, Pax said, why isn't it on a shelf in the living room or in her office?
Beats me.
As Pax leafed through Cookie's Big Adventure, Pogo took the final item from the lockbox.
The saint, bitch.
The who?
Brandishing a few pages of typescript that were held together with a paperclip, Pogo said,
this is the piece Beebs wrote for the professor who made her bail out of the writing program.
He affected a snooty voice to pronounce her name.
Dr. Solange St. Croix.
In this case, Pax said, snarky doesn't work when your name is Averill Beaumont Stanhope III.
Point taken. You ever read this?
She told me about it, but I never saw it.
Pogo passed the 4 pages to him.
Read it. Maybe you'll see what pissed off the great professor. Neither of us can figure it.
Glancing from watch to clock to ovens, Pax said,
maybe I should read it in the car, while we're going wherever you're getting the cassette recorder fixed.
It's in the box with this other stuff. Maybe it has something to do with what's happening. Read it now.
Relenting, Pax read the pages aloud, interrupting himself with laughter a few times, although the amusing lines were never mean.
Totally Bibi.
Vivid,
Pogo agreed.
But I don't see why it made the professor go ballistic.
Okay, then. Maybe that's our best first lead.
How so?
Why don't we visit Saint Bitch and ask her what made her blow like Vesuvius? I know where she lives.
Pax no longer consulted the wall clock or the wristwatch or the LED readouts on the ovens because behind his face, rather than upon it, unseen but sensed, a sweep hand swept away the seconds. He was as acutely aware of the passage of time as he'd been in certain moments of battle, felt time flowing as sand might feel as it slid through the pinched waist of an hourglass. They had found a trove of curious objects, but they had deduced little from them. Considered action was always better than considered inaction, even if talking to a college professor about her response to a student's writing 5 years earlier didn't seem to be enough action to amount to a damn.
Okay,
he said, getting up from the table.
Let's go see the professor. You do the interrogation, Pogo said.
It's not an interrogation, just a chat.
The way she treated Beebs, I wouldn't mind waterboarding her.
I never waterboarded anyone. Never used thumbscrews, electric shocks to the genitals, bamboo shoots under fingernails. Never played loud disco music at anyone to break him. None of that Hollywood stuff. Psychology and a good shit detector are mostly all you need.
Pax folded the sheet of handwritten quotations about imagination and paperclipped it to the 4 pages of Bibi's writing that had so incensed Dr. St. Croix. He tucked them into the Panther and Gazelle notebook that contained the stories about Jasper the dog. He didn't see any reason to take the dog collar or the children's book, or the little plastic bag with the lock of Captain's hair, and Pogo had the tape recorder that needed to be repaired.
Hang in there, Beebs,
he said, and Pogo asked if he thought she could hear him, and he said,
no, but it's not the first time I've talked to her out loud when she wasn't there to hear.
Chapter 101. Devious and Numerous. While Bibi made her way down through the house from which Ashley had been kidnapped, sidling around the gruesome corpses, two spirits of different sizes darted initially at the periphery of her vision, as quick and elusive as bats, although the size of people. They were as silent as before, and again, she sensed that they flung themselves through the house in a state of torment, not fury. They moved even faster than before, in a frenzy. With sudden, unpredictable lunges, they began exploding from the periphery into her immediate presence, startling her even after she came to expect these assaults on her nerve. She began to think that they wanted something from her, and that it was something she could not, must not, give. Repeatedly, with growing boldness, these featureless figures brushed her in passing. Because they lacked substance, she couldn't feel the pressure or texture of their touch, but each time a chill shattered through her. A chill that didn't arise from within as earlier, but burst through her in distinct shards, like a shrapnel of ice, so that in spite of the absence of pain, she half expected to see bloodstains spreading through her clothes. Overcome, in truth, slammed by an urgent need to be out of the house. Alarmed, but not terrified, rising to the challenge of the alarm rather than fleeing in response to it, she holstered the pistol to free both hands. As she descended the stairs from the second floor and crossed the foyer to the front door, she swung her arms at the spirits when they leaped upon her, as if to warn them to stay clear. Because they were as weightless as shadows, she was powerless to throw them off or backhand them aside. She felt foolish, clumsy, but she was convinced that if she didn't mount a resistance, they would become more aggressive and perhaps gain the power to pose a real threat. She erupted from the front door, across a simple brick stoop and into the yard, an expanse of sandy earth and stones and clumps of pale weedy grass that had perhaps never been green, all dimly illumined and heavily shadowed by the moon. As she had hoped, the spirits didn't follow her out of the house, remained tethered to its rooms, in which they had lived and died, and lived again in grief. Bibi ran and stumbled and almost fell more than once before she reached the graveled shoulder of the state route, where she turned to look back at the house. The residence still appeared to be misplaced in space and time. She gasped for breath, waiting for the place to sink as Poe's house of Usher had sunk. But there was no black and lurid tarn there, as there had been in the story, no muck into which the structure could be submerged. With no need to return overland, she followed the pavement to the east, where Pogo's Honda was parked alongside the road. As she walked, she thought of the spirits in the house, about what they might have wanted from her. Of the several wants that came to mind, there was one she knew must be true the moment that it occurred to her. They wanted to delay her, hinder, hamper, which meant they hadn't been, as she'd thought, the spirits of Ashley's dead parents, the shot woman and the beaten man. She had been spared from brain cancer in order to save a life, Ashley's life. But there were forces, both human and supernatural, that wanted Ashley dead. If the girl was murdered, perhaps Bibi's cancer would return, or she would have failed to earn its remission. The walk back to the Honda seemed longer than it should have been, and she began to worry that she had already passed the place where she had parked it, that the car had been stolen, leaving her with no choice but to continue on foot to Sonomir Way. Delay, hamper, hinder. The ink-black, bat-quick spirits in the house hadn't been the only entities that had sought to impede her since all of this had begun. When she had been at the small table in the motel room, making new street names from the lettered tiles that spelled Moonrise, something had knocked on the door, had scratched at the door, had tapped at the windows, distracting and delaying her word search before at last she found Sonomir Way. The fog. The first night, the hampering fog billowed in from the sea, slithered inland, and the following day, it retreated only to repeatedly return, until with sunset and this second night, it thickened into a blinding mass that had slowed her significantly. Now it seemed to her that the fog had been unnaturally dense and persistent.
that it had been settled upon her not by nature, but by whatever power Terezin could command to oppose her actions and retard her progress. Still no Honda. She began to run. Maybe the greater rush of blood from her laboring heart shifted gears of thought in her brain, because as she sought the car, a new and disturbing possibility demanded consideration. Maybe her enemies weren't as devious and numerous as they seemed to be. She could have imagined the knocking, tapping, scratching at the motel, for when she had opened the door and ventured outside, there had been no threat. If the inky spirits hadn't been real, they had been hallucinations, which represented a level of self-deception suggesting derangement. After all, she had earlier turned traitor against herself, cutting the lines from the books by O'Connor and Wilder and London, burning them in the motel bathroom sink to prevent herself from confirming some suspicion she'd had about Chubb Coy. Of course, she couldn't be her only enemy. For one thing, she couldn't imagine a massive fog bank into existence. The fog had to have been conjured by nature, or by Terezin using his occult power. Didn't it? Did it? She stopped in the middle of the highway, heart knocking in its cage of ribs, as if it would slip free and beat away into the night and leave her defeated, dead upon the blacktop. An immense, terrible, vaguely discerned secret or lost memory, swelled darkly at the back of her mind. Bibi could sense its presence, its awesome size, and she knew that its revelation would be devastating. She stood waiting on the road, waiting. The black sky and its moon, its planets, its infinite array of stars began to weigh on her, and a weakness came upon her, so that she thought her knees would fail. An eerie electronic whine, what she imagined tinnitus sounded like to those afflicted with it, rose from ear to ear, and she thought, it's just the inner workings of the damn brain monitor. But had no idea what she meant by that, nor what she intended when she reached to her head to pull off the confining electro cap and found, of course, just the baseball cap. Her vision blurred. Or was it the world around her that blurred, that began to lose coherence, began to diffuse? She closed her eyes. In that instant, she knew what must be happening to her, and she rallied in anger and self-disgust. Fate. She was giving in to the illusion that fate dictated the possibilities of her life. Whatever will be, que sera, sera. Screw that. She loved her parents, but she wasn't them. Fate did not rule her. She was the master of her fate, the captain of her soul. She wouldn't quit. Surrender was not a word that could be made from the lettered tiles of her name. She had come this far, and she would not quit. The trillions of stars weighed less heavily upon her, and the dark matter that constituted most of the universe lifted from her shoulders. And if the piercing whine had been the cry of planets rotating around their liquid cores or something ordinary, in either case, it stopped. She opened her eyes, walked eastward, and the night that had begun to blur now clarified. When she topped a low rise, the Honda waited on the descending slope where she had parked it. Before she opened the driver's door, she looked to the north, across the highway, where the raw land rose slightly, appearing softer in the night than it would in daylight, folding upward like gray blankets under which lay an army of sleepers. Whether a sound had alerted Bibi, or her attention had been drawn by supernatural means, near the limit of vision, she saw the tall figure in the hoodie, and then the dog, both faintly silvered by the moonwash. Her initial impulse was to cross the road, call out, and hurry toward the pair, here where no fog could shroud them and foil her. But then she realized that they were alike to the fog, and to the ink-black spirits in the house, serving the same purpose as whatever had knocked, tapped, scratched at the motel room door and windows. They were here to distract and delay her. That had been their purpose from the beginning. They hadn't healed her. By whatever singularity of her immune system or act of providence she had been made well, the cancer must have been cast out before the man and dog appeared in her hospital room. Whether they were flesh and blood or occult entities haunting her, she would learn nothing from them, even if she managed to catch up with them and snared the tall man by a hoodie sleeve. However ardently Bibi hoped to save Ashley Bell, no matter with what persistence she tracked the girl, there was someone. Terezin, but perhaps someone from whom Terezin was merely a front man, who was equally determined to thwart her. As she watched the ghostly man and dog walking at a distance precisely calculated to minimize their visibility and maximize their otherworldly quality, Bibi wondered if the murder of Ashley wasn't her enemy's ultimate goal. If possibly the girl was only a lure with which they were drawing their most desired victim, Bibi, to a place of no escape. She turned away from man and dog, got into the car, and started the engine. Chapter 102. The Wicked Witch Lets Her Hair Down. Stucco for bread, teak decks for meat, garnished with stainless steel and glass railings. Dr. St. Croix's house was stacked like what in another era would have been called a Dagwood sandwich, named for the hapless Dagwood Bumstead, a cartoon character once much loved by readers of newspaper funny pages, but now largely forgotten. Paxton knew Dagwood from the Blondie comic strip, because his grandmother, Sally Mae Coulter, had enjoyed it almost as much as her all-time favorite comic, Lil Abner. Books had been published, collecting many years of both strips, and Grandma had owned them all. At the front door, Pax said,
"Remember, honey works better than vinegar." "You've seen the photo in that magazine Bibi has, yeah? Looks to me like the famous professor thrives on vinegar." "Maybe she's not even home," Pax said, and he rang the bell.
He almost didn't recognize the woman who opened the door. Gone was the tailored, expensive, but drab suit. She wore an owdye, a flowing silk tunic and pants ensemble, white with irregularly placed peacock blue and ultramarine blue and saffron yellow flowers. Classic Vietnamese apparel, a garment as feminine as any in the entire world of women's fashions. Her hair was usually drawn back into a bun that looked as dense as stone, that gave her the severe appearance of a 19th century pioneer woman who had been hardened by decades spent in a contest with the heat and cold and wind and Indians and innumerable hardships of the prairie. However, on this Sunday afternoon, she had let down her graying hair, which revealed itself as less gray than silver blonde, lustrous and thick, as silken as the owdye. Her skin, always flawless in photographs and public television appearances, was flawless now, but appeared more like flesh and less like quartz. Her eyes, which Bibi had once described as the blue of the chemical gel in a refreezable ice pack, were precisely that color, but there was nothing icy about her stare. Clearly, the professor had once been a head-turning, boy-stunning, all-American babe. At 50-something, she still was, when she wasn't being her public image.
"Dr. St. Croix," Pax began.
Before he or Pogo could say another word, Solange St. Croix saw the ink on Pax's right bicep, said,
"I don't believe it,"
and with one finger pushed up the t-shirt sleeve that half-concealed his only tattoo. It was the official seal emblem, an eagle in an overwatch position on a trident that was also the cross of an anchor, with a flintlock pistol in the foreground, rendered in shades of gold with black detailing.
"Are you a fraud, young man?" she asked.
"Excuse me, ma'am?"
"No, you're not," she decided. "You're the real damn thing, an honest-to-God Navy SEAL. I've only met one before, and everything I wrote about him is locked away where no one can see it, where it'll remain until I'm old enough to want everyone to see it.
Letting the t-shirt sleeve slide half over the tattoo once more, the professor looked at Pogo and smiled, and Pogo blushed, which Pax had never seen him do before. To Pax, with girlish enthusiasm, she said,
"I could use a jolt of the exotic. Tell me you're here in an official capacity, on a mission of grave importance. Your military intelligence, conducting an investigation on which the fate of the nation depends."
"Not the fate of the nation, ma'am. But it is a matter of life and death," Pax said.
He didn't confirm or deny that he was with one branch or another of military intelligence, allowing her to infer that, with academic perspicacity, she had known the truth of him at first sight. Judging by her manner and the delighted surprise in her eyes, Pax thought that this Sunday had been of a grayer cast than she had hoped, as perhaps had been some number of days before it, and that she would insist upon the risk of believing he was what she imagined, welcoming them into her house. More than anything at this moment, perhaps she needed color in her life, while Pax and Pogo offered all the hues of a box of 48 crayons.
"Ma'am, I'm Chief Petty Officer Paxton Thorpe, and this is Averill Beaumont Stanhope III.
"Of the Boston Stanhopes?" the professor asked.
"No, ma'am,"
Pogo replied, lest there be no Boston Stanhopes and her question a trap.
"Of the Virginia Stanhopes."
Which was a lie, but a reasonably smooth one. Pax said,
"If you can spare us 15 minutes, we'd be most grateful. But we can meet with you tomorrow, in your office at the university, if you prefer."
He still half expected her to ask for proof that he was with one intelligence service or another, whereupon he would be able to produce only his military ID, which wouldn't identify him as what he was now pretending to be. But she stepped back from the door and welcomed them inside and led them through dramatic but sterile rooms of starkly modern decor, her audi both loose and yet clinging to her as she seemed almost to float through the shadowy spaces with the grace of a brightly painted koi in half-lit waters. She was barefoot, and her feet were small for a woman of about 5'8", like the well-formed feet of a child destined for ballet.
"I have to stir the soup," she said,
and brought them into a spacious kitchen with a maple floor finished in a gray wash, matching cabinets, black granite countertops, and stainless steel appliances. The soup in the making stood on the cooktop, blue flames caressing the bottom of the large pot.
"Potato leek," she said.
Pax smelled potatoes and leeks and tarragon and an abundance of butter. Padded stools were lined up along one side of the large center island, and St. Croix suggested they sit there. On the island stood a bottle of 18-year-old Macallan Scotch, a container of half-and-half kept cool in a box of ice, and a Baccarat Crystal on-the-rocks glass containing those three ingredients. Whether Dr. St. Croix began drinking by 3:10 on the average Sunday, or whether this indulgence was an exception, she evidently felt no need whatsoever to justify herself. After she finished stirring the soup and set the lid askew on the pot, she produced two more Baccarat glasses. With the certitude of someone who had always done what she wanted and encountered no objections, the professor neither asked if they would join her in a cocktail, nor inquired if they would like something different. Standing across the island from them, as she spoke of her love of cooking and built the drinks, Pax realized that declining the Scotch would be taken as a gross insult, and that in spite of her girlish delight in their visit and her hospitality, she could turn on them in an instant. Pogo watched her through squinted eyes, as if he suspected that she might be concocting poison, but he appeared to have reached the same conclusion as Pax. As St. Croix pushed their drinks across the black granite to them, she said,
"So, you called it a matter of life and death."
Concerned about dropping BB's name without preparation, Pax injected the equivalent of scotch and cream into the absurd military intelligence fantasy.
Life and death, yes. And although it sounds melodramatic, it's also a matter of national security.
A little melodrama is good now and then, the professor said. If life were nothing but Raymond Carver's stories, we'd all go mad. Pax knew who Raymond Carver was, but he thought it more in character if he looked puzzled for a moment before continuing.
Anyway, we're here to ask you about a person of interest to us.
A suspect, she interrupted, seeming to take this as seriously as some people took the con men who phoned and, posing as IRS agents, induced them to wire money to foreign bank accounts.
A suspect, more or less, Pax said. But we're not able to share the details of her activities with you, for security reasons.
A woman? I know a genuine security threat? How stimulating.
Yes, ma'am. A former student. Bibi Blair.
The Sunday softness in her face hardened into school day stone.
That syphilitic little whore.
Chapter 103. Valiant girls do not go mad. Paranoia of a reasonable potency was an essential survival tool. But intense and universal paranoia of the everyone I know is an evil space alien variety was the mantra of a loser. The landscape promoted disorientation. Small clusters of buildings punctuated the barren vastness, but at that hour all were dark, seemingly long abandoned. In the black land, aglow only far to the north, square miles of yellow and cold blue scintillation, but not a light that confirmed civilization. An unearthly fungal phosphorescence. Hot plains of radioactive glass. As Bibi drove through the ever stranger and more hostile night, as it seemed that she had driven out of California into a place with no name and no exit, she felt herself traveling a narrow line between sanity and derangement. Her balance precarious. In spite of the antibiotic ointment that the tattoo artist had applied under the layers of enwrapping gauze, the four words on her right wrist burned as if something worse than inflammation must be at work. Bacteria eating through the flesh, or a toxic chemical imparted with the ink. The 18 letters stung, itched. She had been told not to scratch. She'd left the analgesic cream and fresh bandages at the motel. Nothing with which to change the dressing. No time to change it, anyway. She wondered if the increasing irritation of the 18 small wounds might arise from an intentionally imparted infection. But since she had chosen the parlor at random, worrying that the tattooist might be in league with Terezine was as flaky as the evil space alien theory. When for a few minutes she encountered no traffic moving in either direction, she wondered if roadblocks had been set up behind and ahead of her, and she waited to turn a bend or top a rise and find an execution squad of wrong people. On the other hand, when a vehicle appeared in the oncoming lane, she tensed in expectation that the windshield of the Honda might dissolve in a rain of gunfire. Every motorist closing in behind her might be a tail, and when she cut her speed to let him pass, he always lingered alongside her, or she thought he did, to look her over with malevolent intent. She was still 15 or 20 minutes from Sonomir Way when a disturbing sound rose above the rubber-on-road hum and the drone of the engine. The flapping, flopping noise was like the struggling of a freshly caught fish in a sportsman's creel, and at first she thought that it must be a tire shedding tread. In that case, she would have felt such a problem translated to the steering wheel, a strong pull toward the deterioration, but she didn't. A subsequent silence didn't reassure Bibi, and after less than a minute, the noise came again, this time perhaps from under the car. Something that had slipped loose must be slapping the pavement. But the Honda continued to purr along, and no warning lights appeared on the instrument panel. The third time she heard the sound, she realized that the source was within the vehicle, on the back seat, or on the floor behind the front passenger seat. Then she understood what it must be. The previous night, asleep in the armchair in her father's office above Pet the Cat, she had dreamed the truth of what had happened in her bedroom when she was not quite 6 years old. The truth that she had hidden from herself by using Captain's memory trick of fire and forgetfulness. Not the whole truth, but part of it. In the dream, she hadn't revealed to herself the source and nature of the threat. Only that something malicious had come for her. Had come for her and crawled her room. Had gotten under the covers with her. And here it was again. After a silence in which the thing perhaps nursed its desire and considered its options, the slick and torsional sound rose again, as if this must be some slippery denizen of murky water and swamp mud, out of its element but hardly deterred, determined to make its way through this unfamiliar environment toward what it wanted, needed, toward her. To Bibi, it sounded as though the thing was trying to get purchase on the back of the front passenger seat, or to squirm up the transmission hump and onto the console between the seats, which should have been an easy bit of terrain to conquer. On a straight stretch of highway, Bibi turned her head to look back and down, over the console. The pearly luminosity of instrument panel gauges didn't reach as far as the rear compartment of the car, where shadows pooled and moonlight rushing past the windows revealed nothing. If something coiled or quivered on the back floor, yearning to climb, and if it was watching her, its eyes didn't shine in the gloom. Starboard tires stuttered on the stony shoulder of the roadway. Bibi looked forward, pulled the wheel to the left, and brought the Honda onto the pavement again, just seconds short of a plunge off a low embankment. Whether it was a sign of madness or common sense, or repressed knowledge guiding her without her understanding, Bibi told herself that if only she refused to hear the creature, refused to grant it existence, imagined it gone now and forever, she would be rid of it. Had that strategy worked for her when she had been a terrified child? She couldn't remember. After a minute and the better part of another, the theory seemed to be confirmed. But then a new sound arose from the back of the car. What might have been a voice or an attempt at a voice. Low and wet, a guttero-nasal clutch of syllables that formed no words, but expressed nonetheless a craving, a coveting, a ferocious need, and such bitter and implacable rancor that mere hatred paled before it. Chapter 104. Boozer, Baker, Starmaker. After calling Bibi a syphilitic little whore, Dr. St. Croix took such pleasure in the idea of her former student being in trouble with agencies dedicated to national security that the hardness went out of her face and the Sunday softness returned, though her smile was akin to a vindictive sneer and would have been regarded with disquiet had she been in a room full of church folk. "I knew that deceitful bitch would step into deep shit one day. I hope it's deep enough for her to drown in it. She thinks she's more cunning than she is, and she took me for a sap who could be easily intimidated. Imagine a 17-year-old neophyte daring to attempt to manipulate a woman as experienced and connected and respected as I am. The little fool." Paxton had a moment radically out of character for a Navy SEAL, a Betty Davis moment in which he wanted to throw his drink in the professor's face and say something so cutting that she would need the rest of the year to rebuild her ego. But that wasn't an effective technique of interrogation. Loyal Pogo wasn't as good as he should have been at concealing his rage, and before the professor might glance at the kid and read his revulsion, Pax smiled at him and winked and raised his own glass as if in a toast, though by the gesture he meant to say that taking a drink would be better than throwing a punch. "I will do anything I can," St. Croix said, "anything, to help you convict Ms. Blair of whatever she's done. I don't need to know anything that's classified about the case. If only I can hope that she'll get something between life in prison and the death penalty." She favored Pax with a seductive smile, and he said,
"You have every reason to hope, ma'am. But you understand that I can't share even the smallest details of the pending indictment."
The professor brightened further, spread her arms so that the sleeves of her colorful tunic flared like butterfly wings. "What a lovely word, indictment. That's all I need to hear. I am in such a superlative mood, you cannot know, you cannot possibly know. I was about to start forming tarts when you rang the doorbell. So might I get on with that while you ask your questions, Chief Petty Officer?" Pax couldn't quite compute the words "forming tarts," but he said that yes, of course she could continue with what she had been doing if it didn't interfere with his inquiry. As the professor went to one of the two Sub-Zero refrigerators, Pax tried the scotch with half and half. He was surprised to find the whiskey hadn't curdled the cream, but even more surprised that Dr. St. Croix hadn't curdled it. To medicate his outrage, Pogo had consumed most of his drink in one long swallow. Barefoot and blithe, Solange St. Croix returned to the island with a bowl, over which was draped a dish towel. She whipped off the cloth to reveal a large ball of risen pastry dough.
"I love to bake. I adore it."
From cabinets, she retrieved a baking sheet and